Children are easy to amaze, but as we get older, many of us lose our sense of wonder. Magician Nate Staniforth wants to bring your sense of wonder back. This hour, magic and music. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We may know that the tricks a magician performs are illusions, but there is nothing unreal about the feelings of amazement in the audience. I'll talk with Nate Staniforth about creating astonishment. Then, later in the hour, musician Joseph Firecrow is keeping Cheyenne traditions alive with his wooden flutes. I'll talk with him. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Grammy Award-winning musician Joseph Firecrow is keeping Northern Cheyenne traditions alive with his flute music. He'll be here to talk and play in a little while. But first, we love to watch magic shows. It doesn't matter that we know that the tricks a magician performs are illusions. There is nothing unreal about the feelings of amazement we feel when we see something that looks like magic. Nate Staniforth is a magician who is based in Iowa City. He'll be performing and speaking at the Witching Festival in Iowa City on Friday at 7 p.m. His session is called Magic and the Unknown, Mystery and Wonder in the Modern World. In the interest of disclosure, the Witching Festival is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio. And Nate Staniforth is here with me now. Hello, Nate.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And I know you grew up in Ames, Iowa. And you discovered magic at a pretty early age. Tell me what happened.
So I was 8 or 9 years old, and I read the Lord of the Rings books. And it's sort of a curious age because you're old enough to get through 1,300 pages of pretty obscure fantasy literature, but young enough at the end of that time to still hold out hope that if you go to the adult section of the library, you could find a book of actual supernatural spells that you could learn and then do on the playground.
So a lot of us are still waiting for our Hogwarts letters. So you are not alone in that feeling. But so you actually thought, oh, maybe I could be a wizard.
That was the plan. I wanted to do spells on the playground and impress everybody. So turns out that's not how it works.
But you went to the library. What did you find?
So it was my first time in the adult section of the library, which is a big sort of step for me. And I found a book on sleight of hand. And, you know, the disappointment that it wasn't actual magic was very, very small because you realize, wow, if I get good at this, I can make people think I can do magic, which is, you know.
That's pretty cool.
Very similar, yeah. At least for them, it's the same thing.
So it started with one trick?
It started with one trick. And I don't, you know, I've thought about this a great deal. I have no idea what made me so. I was obsessed with perfecting this illusion. I bet I put 400 hours as a kid. I would come home from school. I would go up to the bathroom so I could see what the spectators would see. And I would just practice this illusion over and over and over again. And it was the first – it looked like actual magic. You put a coin in your hand, close your hand, and then when you open your hand, the coin's gone. And, you know, the first few thousand times it didn't look amazing at all, but I will never forget the first time I opened my hand and it didn't look like magic. It didn't look like a trick. It looked like a miracle, you know? I
thought, the coin is just gone.
This is interesting.
Though you knew exactly where the coin was,
yeah,
you could see the magic.
You could see how other people would think it was magic. But
so you had been practicing this in your bathroom. Had you shown it to anybody in progress?
No. It was because you want it to feel like an amazing moment. You don't want the coin to fall on the floor and then they see that it's not actual magic. But I sort of got into trouble. I decided that I wanted to perform this at school at recess. And, you know, one of the things that you learn about magic is that if the context is wrong, it's not entertaining. It's just terrifying, you know? So the students saw the coin disappear, but they didn't know I was a magician. They didn't know they were watching a trick. They just saw something disappear. So they didn't clap. They didn't applaud. They just started screaming and jumping up and down and running around.
And then what's this, fourth, fifth grade?
Yeah, third or fourth grade,
okay.
Yeah. So the playground teacher, I mean, just imagine you're on duty at playground and you look across the schoolyard and there's this group of kids and then they start screaming and running away and I'm standing in there in the middle.
Right, danger.
So, yeah, right. So she walks over and demands, and, you know, I was intimidated by this teacher and very authoritarian, and she demanded to see whatever it is that I showed them. So I made the coin disappear for her. and I will remember the look of wonder on her face for the rest of my life. So that's how it started, with one coin trick.
Was she encouraging when she saw this?
I don't remember.
But you knew that you had amazed her.
The detail that stuck with me. I mean, it's an interesting story, but the more I think about it, the stranger it gets, because I knew that it was just a trick. I was just a 9-year-old boy, 10-year-old boy, whatever it was. And the response that I would get from this coin trick was to such a degree out of proportion to the causes that I still don't know how to explain it. Let me put it this way. If I had taken that same 400 hours and put it towards something else, like learning the cello, and I had dragged my cello out to the playground, I could have played something. You know, I don't know how far 400 hours gets you on the cello. It might have been beautiful. They might have liked it. But it wouldn't have had that crush of power and fear and joy behind it. And so, I didn't pursue a career in the entertainment industry because I wanted to be in show business. I learned at a very young age that you can say something with a magic trick that's hard to say any other way. And I wanted to figure out how to do that.
Yeah. That feeling. You wanted more of that feeling.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, you knew you wanted to be a magician?
Yeah. That's right. From a very young age, I knew that this is what I want to do. And it was just a question of how do I make that happen?
So did you start performing as an amateur magician in elementary, junior high, that kind of thing?
For better or for worse, I did, yeah. One of the advantages I had growing up in Ames, Iowa, is that I was literally the only act in town. And so if the Boy Scouts wanted a magician, they had no option but to call 11-year-old Nate and bring him in. And so I did like bridge groups and book clubs and Boy Scouts, and the firemen had me in for their annual dinner. And you know, there were a lot of terrible shows. And fortunately, after you do a lot of terrible shows, the shows start to get less terrible. And so you can get experience faster than I think you could if you were growing up in New York or Chicago or Los Angeles and trying to become a magician. So.
Now, it's one thing when a cute 11-year-old says, hey, I want to be a magician, and puts together a magic show. It's something else entirely when your 18-year-old child says, well, I'm going to dedicate my career to being a magician. Yeah. I'm going to go off. Yes, I'll go to college, but this is my goal. How did your family react?
To their credit, they took it very well. I think everyone was eager to see how it turned out. Let me put it that way. But I think sometimes you know something about yourself that you just have to prove to everybody else. And yeah, I had the space to do that.
Now, you came to the University of Iowa, and I can imagine a lot of people who really want to go into magic, become magicians, probably don't necessarily go to college. There's no real course study that you can pursue. What was your plan?
Well, so I had a theater scholarship, and I didn't know how to break into the entertainment industry. So I thought maybe I'll go study theater and learn how to be a magician, you know, or learn something that I could put in the show. But what I discovered is that you get far better experience just doing magic for people. And, you know, Iowa City has the Ped Mall. It's a big university town, so I could do frat parties and sorority parties. And there is a performance art space above one of the bars downtown that gave me a weekly show. And, so every week I would have to come up with new material for the show. So I was a terrible student. I lost interest in my classes very quickly. But I got a lot of experience learning how to perform. And if you can do magic for drunk college guys, you can do magic for anybody.
So. I don't know. It seems to me that maybe they'd believe a little bit better
than a completely sober
audience. So as you were going through that experience, I mean, I know that it's that sense of really blowing somebody's mind that you were looking for. But I'm guessing you had a lot of rough nights. What was it that kept you going?
Well, here's what I would say. I think everyone at some point should learn one really great magic trick, because you get to see a side of people that is completely hidden any other time. You know, usually when you wake up in the morning, you sort of choose the clothes that you wear to give out the image that you want to give out to the rest of the world. And you choose your words in a specific way to make people feel about you a certain way. And one of the things I love about magic is it strips all of that away for a second. A moment of genuine impossibility makes you forget to be cool. And so you get to see this side of people that's not performing, that's not acting. They're just openly responding to that moment. And it's an amazing thing. And so once you realize that you can do that on your good nights, it makes the bad shows easier to easier to deal with.
So even though you are dealing with illusion and with tricks, it's that complete raw honesty in the audience that really appeals to you.
It is. And I would also say that, you know, you can't be a good magician unless you know how to remain open and susceptible to the, you know, experience of wonder and astonishment. And one of the best ways to experience that yourself is to get really good at giving it to other people. It's just, you know, in that shared experience, you feel the same thing. And you know, when you're on the road as a magician, most of the day is spent waking up and driving to the airport and flying and then getting another rental car and driving to the venue. You know, there's 14 or 15-hour workday of traveling before you ever get to the venue for the show. But in that 90-minute performance, it absolutely sort of redeems all of that effort, because for 90 minutes you get to do magic for people and you get to see them respond to it, and that's pretty amazing.
As you were performing all of these shows at the University of Iowa and trying to, you know, decide what direction you would go with your life, it seems that you had options as a magician. I mean, there are different kinds of magicians.
Sure.
Did you try out being different kinds of magicians?
I did, yeah. In high school, there were a couple of years where I wore a tuxedo and had a smoke machine and lights, and I would dance around on stage to 80s power ballads. And
did you have a white tiger?
I did not. It might have helped, you know. And I still think there's not anything inherently wrong with that, but it just looked ridiculous coming from me. You know, you have to sort of wear the suit that fits, and I am much more comfortable doing magic the way I do it now than trying to be somebody else. You know, the world doesn't need another David Copperfield. They don't need another Siegfried and Roy or David and Blaine. We've already got good
those
versions.
People, right.
Yeah, they're still working.
But you did try sort of big events. I've heard that when you were at the University of Iowa, you chained yourself and went underwater in the Iowa River.
This is true.
How did that go?
Well, so I had a weekly show on the university cable channel that ended abruptly after this stunt. But at the end, so every week, you know, I would bring a camera crew around town and film magic for people, and then we'd put it on after the Russian news and before the lunch schedule. My 15 minutes of magic would be on. And at the end of the first year, I realized that we need something big to finish the first season, and so I've always been interested in Houdini and his escapes, and I decided that I was going to do an underwater escape in the river. And I was locked and chained and waited, and we had to delay the escape because the river was still frozen over. It was 52 degrees
oh,
at
my.
The surface. And just to put that into context, when you take a cold shower, that's 65-degree water. You know, so it's way colder than you get in the bathroom. And it was awful. Thank you for bringing it up.
Right. Well, I think we'll talk more about it after a break. With me this hour is magician Nate Staniforth. He is based in Iowa City. He grew up in Ames. He'll be performing and speaking at the Witching Festival in Iowa City on Friday at 7 p.m. His session is called Magic and the Unknown, Mystery and Wonder in the Modern World. This is Talk of Iowa.
You fly so high.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, a conversation with Grammy Award-winning musician Joseph Firecrow. He is keeping Northern Cheyenne traditions alive with his wooden flute music. We'll hear from him later on. With me now is magician Nate Staniforth. He is based in Iowa City. He'll be performing and speaking at the Witching Hour Festival in Iowa City on Friday at 7 p.m. His session is Magic and the Unknown, Mystery and Wonder in the Modern World. And Nate, just before the break, we were talking about the time that you chained yourself up and had to escape from those chains underneath the water in the Iowa River.
I mean, a lot of people do stupid things when they're freshmen in college,
right.
But this is just very public.
So how did it go?
It was one of the worst experiences of my entire life. It was so much colder than I imagined. And, you know, I read a lot of Houdini's thoughts on escape, and his number one, he wrote this over and over in his journal, that panic is the enemy, because you can train, you can learn to work the locks, you can learn to hold your breath, you can learn to be comfortable in cold water. But if you panic, all of that goes out the window. So I sank. Okay, so I was locked. I was practically naked, locked and chained, and I jumped in the water and I sank to the bottom of the Iowa River and immediately realized that this was a terrible decision. And all of the practice and all of the, you know, everything I had worked on was gone, and it was dark and it was cold, and I was staring up at the surface of the river from the other side, just, you know, miserable and wanting to be out of this. But I was locked and chained and I couldn't get anywhere. So I, you know, started working on the locks, and we thought of everything. I had, you know, I felt like I had prepared completely for this, but the one thing we didn't take into account was the current of the river. And we were filming this for the TV program. And so in order for the boat to stay in the same spot on the river, it had to have the motor running. So as I escaped from the weights, I started floating back towards the surface of the water under the boat.
Oh, no.
Towards the spinning propeller. And so there's this moment of realization that, no, I'm not going to drown. I'm actually going to get hacked to death by this propeller, because I didn't think of that. So the last 10 seconds or so were this mad swim as I'm trying to get away from the propeller. And it worked out okay, but someone saw this and called the police, and the university was not thrilled with me. And that's another story for another time.
You hadn't let people know. Okay.
It was one of those things where it's easier to do and ask forgiveness for it than get permission.
Right. So after that moment, I mean, was that a defining moment in your career? Did that help you make some decisions about what kind of magician you wanted to be?
No, I'm terrible at learning from my mistakes. And so here I am, Charity.
So as time went on, you moved on. You started doing shows all over the country.
That's right.
And you do a lot of traveling. Tell me, you mentioned how I became the kind of magician I am today. What is your show like today? What kind of magician are you?
So it's very stripped down and unadorned with smoke machines or comedy or, you know, I'm not – I say this and people laugh when I tell them this, but I'm not actually interested in entertaining the audience. I think that as soon as you try to anticipate what they're hoping for and give that to them, audiences can sense that very clearly. And so I'm not there to tell jokes. I'm not there for special effects. I have one goal during the show, and that's just to create that moment of astonishment and wonder and mystery. Because if you're looking for, you know, a night of comedy, go see a comedian. They put everything they have into crafting those jokes. And if you want special effects, go see a movie. People are very good at that. The experience that you can get at a magic show is very hard to find anywhere else, is that moment of staring directly into the unknown and responding to that. And, you know, I have performed all over the world. And one of the things that I've noticed is that every culture has its own version of the magician. Every country, every people has that sort of archetypal figure exists everywhere. But it's different in every culture, every region. And so when you perform something that looks like a magic trick, people respond as much to their pre-existing set of, you know, their pre-existing relationship with that archetypal figure. So if your uncle shows you a card trick at Thanksgiving, it could be the most amazing card trick in the world, but you have already thought about card tricks. You know that magic in America is sort of like Job from Arrested Development. And so you'll respond to that as a trick. But as soon as magic becomes good enough that it doesn't look like a trick, that it looks like a miracle, people respond the same everywhere in the world. And I just think that's amazing. It's like whatever happens in a magic show is tapping into something that's fundamentally human. I'm very interested in learning more about that.
Being on the road and doing shows throughout the year has to be a really grinding existence. And you reached a point where you thought maybe this wasn't for you. Tell me about that crisis. What brought you to the point where you thought, oh, maybe I've gone in the wrong direction?
Well, I had been on the road for 5 years touring the college circuit in America. And, you know, one of the paradoxes of the magician's craft is that the better you get at creating magic for people, sometimes it becomes harder to feel for yourself, because a magic trick isn't amazing when you know the secret. And at that point, I had learned all of the secrets. And so or most of the secrets. And so I got to this point where I was just bored, and I knew I could walk into any room and do magic for people, and it just wasn't as significant for me as it had been. And so I was thinking maybe I'll quit and just work at a coffee shop, or maybe I will stop and take a step back and dream this all up again. And so I bought a ticket to India and left on this adventure. And the goal was to examine magic in another culture and see what I could learn about my own craft and my own tradition by putting myself in the audience in this entirely different tradition of magic. And so I saw street performers and snake charmers and mystics and con men and, gurus, anyone who would talk with me. I went there to learn, and it was incredible. It was an amazing experience.
When was this?
2009.
Why India?
It was just a coincidence. When you're on the road, you end up reading a lot because you're just in the airport or the hotel room all the time. And I just happened to be reading a book about traditional Indian magic that I had found at a bookstore. And there was a picture section in the middle where it just looked fundamentally different from the magic in America. It wasn't about card tricks and tight leather pants. It was raw and visceral, and it looked like something that you needed to experience firsthand.
So I guess, we have a lot of stereotypes about magicians. You mentioned Joe from Arrested Development, and there was, of course, the Magicians Guild in Arrested Development.
Sure.
Magicians are not allowed to share their secrets. In going to India and trying to observe but also learn from people who were performing magic, did you have a hard time getting inside and getting them to share their secrets?
Sometimes, yeah. There were some that didn't want to talk with me at all, but what I've learned is that, learning to be a magician is a difficult and a very unique process, and you can recognize in someone who's done the same thing that they've crossed some of the same bridges that you have, and I felt a very close kinship with some of the magicians, and I think they felt that with me as well. You do this thing where you perform for each other, and they could see that I at least knew what I was doing, and I could admire the technical aspects of their work, and they could admire the technical aspects of my work. So yes and no to both of those things.
I'm talking with magician Nate Staniforth. He is based in Iowa City. He'll be performing at the Witching Hour Festival in Iowa City on Friday at 7 p.m. And you, in going to India, how long were you there?
It was a 5-week trip.
Okay.
There were a few other stops as well.
And you went to sort of find a sense of renewal and learn about something that was new to you. Were you surprised by what you found?
Yeah, very much so. One of the things I learned is that travel and magic are very similar in that they strip away the expected and the routine. And they both force you very immediately into the present moment. And, when you're watching a magic show and suddenly there's a tiger on stage, that wakes you up in a very similar way to waking up one morning and seeing the sunlight, glinting off the Ganges River at the foothills of the Himalayas and just sort of having this moment like, how did I get here? I'm very suspicious of certainty and routine, and both do a very good job of dissolving those.
You are working on a book about this journey and your experiences in India right now, but you went looking for renewal, and clearly you found it.
Yeah.
How did it change your direction as a magician?
That's a big question, but let me just throw this out there. I think when you're young, it's easy to be amazed, because the world is new and you're new in it, and you don't have to look far for something that will take your breath away or surprise you or engage you in a way that you've never, in which you've never been engaged. When you're an adult, that becomes a choice. You have to actively look for that, because certainty is seductive, and it's so easy to just sort of to shut down that part of your brain that looks for questions and to live in a way that suggests you know how everything works. And the experience for me was very much one that made me feel that in order to be fully awake and alive and to not go to sleep, that you have to, when you're a grown-up, look for those things and consciously choose to seek them out wherever you can find them.
we, as humans, we tend to seek out knowledge. We're looking for answers, and things that look magical when you're a child are often easily explained by science or maybe by a trick.
Yeah.
So as we grow, I mean, we are harder and harder to amaze, although in a way that's a good thing, right? That we're seeking and amassing knowledge.
It is. But I think the point of danger there is assuming that knowledge and mystery are mutually exclusive. I think the magician operates from the absolute conviction that familiarity does not breed contempt, that learning more about anything makes that thing more amazing rather than less. Like, I like the example of lightning. You know, when you learn that lightning is the cataclysmic discharge of a static electricity that builds up in the atmosphere that strikes the earth once every second of every minute of every hour of every day, every year, you know, forever. Lightning is striking the world everywhere at some point. And that when you learn that and really internalize what that means, that makes it far more amazing rather than less. And I think one of the things that magic can do is it can bring that mystery and that sense of wonder about the natural world sort of unexpectedly into the theater where the audience isn't expecting to find it.
A lot of us, when we see a magic show, particularly if there is one trick that really wows us, really blows us away, yeah, we want to know how that's done.
Yeah.
Now, after a show, do you have people who come up to you and say, how did you do that?
Here's what they say, and this happens everywhere. They come up to me and say, I just want to know how that's done. And I think they mean it. I think they believe that all they want is the answer, that will make them happy. But what they forget is that during the show, I can watch them responding. And there's another side to it, too. They want the answer, but they also want the mystery. Any magician will tell you that at a children's birthday party, when you do magic, it's the adults in the back of the room who respond with far more enthusiasm and power than the children. You know, I think magic is most potent for those who maybe feel like they've lost it, like the bell in the Polar Express. And I think there's that side of it too. You know, there's this contradiction. People want answers and they also want mystery. And at a magic show, you want to know how it's done, but you also want to be amazed. And I'm okay with that contradiction. I think keeping people right, sort of poised between those two polar opposites is a good place to be.
In this day of information, most of the time I could probably turn to a very popular search engine,
yeah,
and say, hey, how is this done?
Yeah.
So do you feel like when somebody knows the answer, does that destroy the amazement?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, because I don't have magic powers. I'm not. You know, I'm very honest with the audience about that. I'm not performing supernatural magic for them. And I think, you know, whatever I have to offer them happens in that process of unknowing, of not having anything to grab onto, that moment where your mind sort of goes into free fall. I love that. I love that more than just about anything. And I think you have to be careful not to kill that too quickly.
So having found this renewed sense of purpose and maybe rediscovered your own sense of wonder and your own sense of amazement, how do you translate that into your performance? How does that make you different from the guy in the tuxedo with the tiger?
I mean, that's the question. How do you tell ghost stories to people who don't believe in ghosts? How do you do magic for people who don't believe in magic? That may be a longer conversation for another time, but I think the first step is to be honest with them and to acknowledge outright that I don't have magic powers. Because the problem that every magician faces is that you could see the most incredible thing at a magic show, but everyone would then go home and they would stare at the ceiling, unable to sleep, thinking, ah, how did that happen? How did that tiger appear on stage? But at some point, everyone just rolls over and closes their eyes and says, you know, whatever, it's just a magic trick. I don't care anymore. I'm going to sleep. Right? Everybody does that. So you have to take that option away from them at the beginning. You have to say, this is a trick. I'm going to show you something. Magic is fiction. You know, that's no one goes to the theater, goes to a play and leaves thinking, wow, that was a fun story, but I don't think those were real pirates singing. I think those were actors. You know, that's ridiculous. So the magician's first job is to teach the audience that it's one, that it's fiction, and two, that that doesn't preclude it from also being valuable.
What is your journey from this point, do you feel like you have found a place where you were headed to? Is this your destination?
I'm very suspicious of ever getting to that place. I like sort of being hungry and chasing after whatever's next. I'm working on a theater tour for next year and, you know, designing new material for that and working on the book and all of these things.
I feel like it's clear that you feel that that sense of amazement is something that's incredibly valuable outside of the world of a magic show as well. Is that what you're trying to communicate to people? Are you hoping that when people leave the theater, they'll be able to carry that sense out into the real world?
Yeah, very much. I mean, I feel like I'm suspicious of art with a message. I feel like it's sort of art for art's sake, and that's a good enough message. So I've never been able to verbalize what it is that I'm trying to give an audience, but I think through the instrument of a magic show, I can show it to you. So,
Nate, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Nate Staniforth is a magician who is based in Iowa City. He'll be performing and speaking at the Witching Hour Festival, a new festival in Iowa City. He'll be performing on Friday at 7 p.m. His session is called Magic and the Unknown, Mystery and Wonder in the Modern World. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Grammy Award-winning musician Joseph Firecrow. He's keeping Northern Cheyenne traditions alive with his wooden flute music. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Joseph Firecrow is a modern Grammy Award-winning musician, but the traditions he draws upon in his music are ancient. He is of Northern Cheyenne descent, and he plays the traditional wooden flute. On Thursday, he'll be speaking and performing at Iowa State University in the sunroom of the Memorial Union at 7 p.m. His program is Native Stories and Flute Music of the Great Plains. It's free and open to the public. Hello, Joseph.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's good to be here.
And I think before we start talking, I would love for you to play us a little something so that those of us who haven't heard your music can get familiar with what you do.
Okay, here comes a flute. Tough Ben, the wooden flute.
Joseph Firecrow playing his wooden flute. And is this a kind of music that you grew up hearing?
As a little boy on the reservation, it's located in southeastern Montana, the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. In the evening time, we would hear the flute men playing their flutes, and it kind of just relaxed you. And it was the end of the day, and then the storytelling from the grandparents or, you know, my father, they would tell stories. And in a simple, and even before then, before radio and all that, this was a very important time to come together as family and to really enjoy each other's presence at the end of the day, and then get ready for a good rest.
Before you actually learned to play the flute, you learned to make flutes, right?
Yes. I when I went to college, my alma mater is Brigham Young University. John Rayner was my mentor, and he was teaching a Native American music class, and he incorporated the wooden flutes at that time, and he taught everyone from the boys to the girls. There was, you know, maybe 20 people or so, and he taught us 4 singing songs, and that was half our grade, and then the other half, if we could make a flute that would just make a sound, and that was the other half of our grade, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, and clearly it became a pretty powerful experience for you because it changed the trajectory of your life. What was it about that experience that made you want more?
Well, it was the ability to get away from the sheet music. You know, I played the trumpet from 4th grade and up into college, and I like that ability to, well, just to improv, but to, you know, just to do what the instrument would do itself. And it was so beautiful and evoked strong emotions. And I remembered it when I was young, and it just seemed to come together. And I really, really enjoyed playing it.
The stories are that you talked about, the people from the Northern Cheyenne sharing in the evenings and the music. Are these all part of an auditory tradition, or is there written music that you could learn to play?
Well, in the old days, in the time before my grandfathers, the oral tradition was very much alive, and it's still alive today. And that's how we prefer to teach these stories and these songs, this music. And there is music structure as well. And today we write our music down. We also record it. And we've crossed over into all genres of music, from rap, hip hop, to rock and roll and classical. So we're covering the gamut of all the musical styles that are there. But it's important to remember the oral tradition, and it is a living tradition, and it's rich and full, and it very colorful. You can paint awesome things, not at the landscape, but the animals and people, and even the stars, moon, sun, everything.
There's a story about the origin of the flute. Can you share that with us?
Oh, yes. I recently had the great opportunity of performing with the Boise Philharmonic in Nampa and Boise earlier this month. And it tells about the story of how the flute came to the people. The composer, his name is Jim Cockey, and the conductor, Robert Franz, really helped us get this story to the people. And the story starts like this. Long ago, there was a young man named Twin, because he was a twin. And he went hunting into the Powder River country. He had a successful hunt, but on his journey home, he was caught by the dark, and he was forced to seek refuge near some sand rocks. He set up camp, and he built the fire, and he ate. Then he heard a sound floating across the hills, and he became afraid, because he'd never heard this sound before. It was beautiful. He went to sleep, and in his dream he heard something above him in the sand rocks. He heard hooves scraping the sand rocks above him. It was the elk. And the elk spoke to him, and he said, I have a gift for you. Take this gift with you and share it. You are bringing a wonderful gift to all the people. In the morning, he awoke, and he went to the top of the sand rocks to where he had heard the elk, and lying there, wrapped in sage, was a bone flute. He took this flute with him, and he continued on home. The elk had instructed him on how to use it and when to use it, of how he was to play it for all the people, especially in the evening times. The elk also instructed him on what he should do with this gift when he was done in this life, that when he would go back home to Creator, that this flute should be taken back to where it was given to him. And so, upon his death, this flute was taken back to the sand rocks. Twin had followed through with this wonderful gift, and with his life, he had spread love, the gift of the elk.
In Northern Cheyenne tradition, it was the warriors that carried flutes. Why is that?
In a simple time, and sometimes very harsh, a warrior did not have time to be too compassionate. And so this was kind of balanced him out as a warrior, that he could show his softer side. And he would play his flute for the love of not just his wife, but his children and his grandparents and the land and the animals, and especially the love he has for the other warriors. And in doing so, he was helping heal each other, their wounds and their spiritual side. And so all young men carried flutes, and it was used not only in courtship, but it was also used to call people to the ceremony, to the dance, and also just for the simple enjoyment of the people. And coming from the warrior, it had very strong meaning. And I asked a question to my elders, why just the men and not the women? Why don't women play flutes? And the answer was simple and direct, and it was this: they do not need them. Just like that.
You, when you're performing on Thursday, your program is Native Stories and Flute Music of the Great Plains. Have you gone beyond your own tribal traditions to incorporate the traditions of other groups?
Yes. Every now and then someone will ask me to learn a sunrise song from the Zuni or, war dance from the Lakota. And so I will do that. And a lot of these songs are very specific and usually from the social spectrum, not the ceremonial. Ceremony is for a given time, given place. And usually anything that's social isn't really around the ceremonial thing. And so what I concentrate on is the social aspect of what these songs are and what their meaning is and how to do them. And they want you to do it just right and not to change it up too much, maybe in tempo or a little bit of rhythm here. But you try to stay close to how you learned it. And, that way we keep the integrity, the authenticity, the genuineness of this wonderful art form, but it is a living form. And so when I'm called to do that, sure. At the same time, we got the modern stuff that's coming around and a modern melody coming, like, say, from me, traditionally based. One day, this song will be considered a traditional song, and it'll be long after we're gone. And it's important to remember not to go too far. You know, we don't want to upset our elders too much. But that happens from time to time.
How many people are keeping these traditions alive? I mean, clearly you're very high profile and you've done a great deal to preserve these traditions. Is there a strong community of musicians with the Northern Cheyenne and with other tribes who are playing these traditional flutes?
Oh, very, very much. There's always somebody doing something. And whether, you know, it's the drum groups, the singing groups, the dancing, and especially the storytelling and how to make flutes. That is really important. And the full complement of a flute man is not just having the ability to make to play a flute, but it's the ability to make one. And the elders are always watching you to make sure that you do this right. And when you're following your heart and this is your passion, they realize that you're the one that's going to be carrying the flute. And so then the information that comes with it. And it comes in bits and pieces. And the reason why is the elders want to make sure that you're decent with this and honest, very honest with this information, and that you're going to be there for the people, not to make it all about yourself. And that's where the real, you know, the recognition of the elders is so, so important. And when they realize that you're giving them the honor, because that's where it literally comes from, they've been keeping this around all their lives, they want to make sure that it's there for the following generations to come. And so when they see a person that has got a good heart and a good medicine with them, then they will give them the fullness of this living tradition, whether it be drumming, singing, or flutes. And I'm just talking from the social part. And then the rest, you know, especially the ceremonial or even the warrior societies that make up the people. And so I can go back home on the reservation and I will speak to our flute men and say hello and, you know, exchange ideas or just, you know, play a song for each other. And at the same time, you know, when you're coming up the ranks, so to speak, they want to test you. And so they may say, make me a flute out of this. And hopefully you can. And you know, then you go, here you go. And you know, that's happened to me in my younger years as I was becoming a flute man. And, you know, it's there are some tribes that have lost so much that one of the things that they lost were they're given flute songs and the stories that come with them, even the ability to make them. And so that's why we really need to keep doing this. And most of all, to recognize our elders.
Joseph Firecrow, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You bet.
Would you play something for us as we end the program today and tell me what you're going to play?
Well, I would actually like to sing a song.
Okay.
The songs that come with our flutes are called wolf songs. And this song, I dedicate it to my wife. Her name is Joanne. And she's from the Italian tribes, Sicilian. And the words in this song say this: I walk with you, and that is enough. I kiss you, and it is good. I walk with you, and that is enough. I am with you, and it is good. We are, 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 we are,
Grammy Award-winning musician. He is of Northern Cheyenne descent, and he'll be speaking and performing at Iowa State University in the Sunroom of the Memorial Union on Thursday at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa.
Zippy Vatamo, oh Hanukkahi, Nawusimu Hai, oh Hanukkahi, Ipava Ehai, we Ai Hai, oh.